Hi, this is Zachary Hill.
And this is Maria Buyukos.
And you're listening to Creative Honey. Hi, everyone. This is a special podcast for us today because we're doing our first kind of roundtable discussion or like interview with our friend Nathan Ryan. Say hello, Nate.
Hello, Nate. I don't know. That was dumb.
Oh, man. No, that's, you know, I got to watch what I say. You know, no,
pre-roll, I was telling you I didn't have enough coffee today, and that's showing already.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, coffee makes the world go round, especially in our world. So totally understandable.
It's true. Uppers and downers, right?
Yep, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. But yeah, no, Nate, a little bit about Nate. We've been really good friends for a long time. And he is currently running a creative agency called Toy that's based out of Austin. And we came together a few years ago on a project called ProxArt. And that's what I'll say about our relationship and your background, Nate, if you want to kind of piggyback off that and kind of open up on your background and how we've worked together and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, I'm really excited to be on the podcast. I think what you guys have going on is really, really cool. Zach, if I can, just really quickly, you know, you've always been one of my favorite artists, and it's been fun to see your evolution into design and illustration and all that, and what you guys have going on, what you and Maria have with Hill and B is just awesome. So I'm excited to be involved in any small way, including the podcast. But my background is in publishing and in design. As you mentioned, Zach, I'm currently running Toy. We're a digital design agency, 4 offices. We just opened this one in Austin in January and are slowly moving management out here, but we also have offices in LA, in San Francisco, and in Buenos Aires. But I got started working in, you know, freelancing for different design studios and things like that in the LA area. Went on and worked with Disney for a while. Worked with a couple other agencies in the LA area, one called Midnight Oil, another one called Something Massive. And then Zach, as you mentioned, on the side that whole time, you and I were working on ProxArt with a team of friends. And just to give everybody a quick background on what ProxArt was, we were just trying to expose cool art in different cities around the world, really. And somehow it took off. We had an audience, and it was just a lot of fun to see people kind of come out of the woodwork for just this like labor of love, which I think is actually kind of right in line with some of what we're going to be talking about today. So it'll be fun to kind of reminisce on some of that while we also talk through, you know, our topic today.
Perfect. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, on that note, actually, that's, you know, wanted to bring you on because, you know, you're a good friend of mine, and I think you know what you're talking about when it comes to the creative world. But I know that you posted an article recently about kind of the do what you love culture and mantra, and how that, you know, doesn't always work out as, you know, as sunshine and roses or whatever as it makes it seem to believe out there in the internet culture. So,
right.
Yeah. So what do you think about that?
What do I think about the article, or what
just kind of like
culture?
Yeah, just kind of the general, you know, what we kind of talked about, kind of in our notes here a little bit, and just kind of how your general. Why did you post that article, basically?
To me, I posted it not necessarily because I think that the slogan is necessarily bad, or the mantra. I guess it's not a slogan; it's probably more of a mantra, but I didn't post it because I think that the mantra is bad. I posted it because I think that the long-term, bigger effects of something like that mantra can be bad and have shown themselves to be bad. And I think that, and I should amend that to say that I don't think it's bad all the time, and I don't think it's bad for everybody, but I think it can be used in a way that's very coercive. And so for me, and just for everybody that's listening, this was an article in Slate called In the Name of Love by Mia Tokomitsu. I think I said that right.
Yeah.
Again, sounds good. Coffee. and the whole premise of the article was basically people who ascribe to this mantra, do what you love, end up getting taken advantage of over the long term. And I do think that's true. I mean, my initial thoughts are just that the main way that it can be used to be coercive are that it keeps wages down. Mm-hmm. It keeps creatives from being able to actually earn the money that they need to earn to even just, you know, not just make a living, but pay back student loans if they did go to school. And you know, in most of the cities where they would be employing this kind of a mantra, you know, you're not talking about low cost of living in San Francisco or Los Angeles or New York or, you know, Austin is a little bit different, but even still, it's still expensive and it's getting more expensive. So in the places where this mantra is used, it becomes a tool to undervalue people.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, Maria.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point because, I mean, you hear a lot of people trying to be, you know, bring a positivity to that, you know, phrase by explaining, you know, it helps people kind of get through the day or have that light at the end of the tunnel. But when we read the article, we thought it was really interesting about how it talks about how corporations and things like that will like to use that to manipulate people who are loving what they do. And so we were like, oh man, okay, yeah, that could actually happen. Do you think that there are people who can do what they love and maybe like have a plan, you know, like they're like, okay, so I'm gonna take this job. It's not like what I really wanna do yet, but this is gonna help me do what I love in the future. Do you think there's like a positive spin to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, I actually don't think that it's a bad goal for people. Mm-hmm. You know, do I think that every job in every industry is going to be the kind of thing that, somebody loves? Not necessarily. Do I think that everybody needs to constantly be taking a job because they love every aspect of it? No. But do I think that working towards that is a bad thing? I also don't think it's a bad thing to be working towards that. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think if you look at the work that you're doing today as a stepping stone to the work that you want to be doing tomorrow, then you can love what you're doing, even if it's not exactly what you want to be doing someday.
Right.
If that makes sense. So,
yeah.
You know, to me, it's... To me, it's more about making sure that you've got that goal in your head, and then it's learning how to love the process of what you do, and maybe not necessarily love the actual job all the time.
Right.
Yeah. No. I think that's a good point, Nate. Because you know I think we should be in love with the process and the evolution of where we kind of end up. I think a lot of people, and I, you know, I'm sure I've fallen into this trap, we kind of fall in love with the destination, you know, like the goal, and we don't think about the process and the evolution. You know, all three of us started off doing different things than we're doing now, and
right.
you know, we've kind of embraced that, but I think some other people don't always do that because they're so fixated on doing what they love in like a certain, very specific way. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that people. Well, and here's so I love Slate. I think Slate posts a lot of really good articles that challenge a lot of thinking. I also think they can be kind of combative for the sake of being combative.
Oh, sure.
You know, and that's kind of their angle. So with this article, you know, they tended to kind of lean into other industries where I don't necessarily know if, you know, this kind of mantra would apply, you know, and they get, you know, they start quoting Thoreau and they start getting into all this stuff where you're like, okay, I get it. We're going to overanalyze this to hell. Like, that's just what's going to happen here. But I think at the end of the day, what it boils down to in my mind is, you know, do you know what you want? And do you know that what you're doing right now is going to help you get there?
Yeah.
Right.
No, I think that's a great point. I think like, what I got, you know, from the article, or like the main point I kind of pulled away from it was that I think there's a culture, a dangerous culture that's kind of growing from the DWYL mantra where there's, especially in the creative industries that we're in, that, and you kind of talked about this, that, you know, there's so many creatives out there that are undervaluing themselves at a really kind of a detrimental level where they can, like you said, you know, they can't pay the rent. They're interning when they shouldn't be interning. They're taking $11 an hour job where they should be doing something for $25 or $50 an hour, but just so they could do what they love, you know? So I think it's almost like that mantra is taking some creatives, you know, especially the creative world, taking people, taking those creatives hostage almost.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. And for me, you know, I feel like whether you're working for free or you're working at a wage that's way lower than what you work, that work ultimately ends up devaluing the industry as a whole. So yesterday I gave a talk, here at WeWork, which ironically, I hope they don't have like, you know, recorders here in these booths. Cause their whole mantra is do what you love. Like that's it. That's actually it. I have two t-shirts that say do what you love on it. But I gave a talk here yesterday and I was talking about the different, configurations of creative service providers, basically. So you have freelancers, you have, you know, design studios, which is what you guys are, where you have a very specific aesthetic and you have a very specific set of deliverables that you can produce on and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, firms or companies would come to you and they would ask you guys to design something in your style or divert a little bit but still retain your style. That's what you guys do.
Yeah.
And then agencies are, you know, we are supposed to be able to do it all. And so what does that look like? And the reason I wanted to give that talk here is because, number one, we get asked a lot if we are available for work that's just literally we're not built for it. And I mean that sometimes they have a very specific need and a very specific aesthetic that they're looking for. And it would be better if they went to somebody like Hill & B because they're going to get something that's more authentic for that than if they come to us. Or sometimes they need something really quickly and they need really tight control over a timeline. They also have a lower budget, in which case they probably need a freelancer or somebody like that.
Totally.
And the reason I wanted to talk about that, again, is because it's all about getting the right project with the right partner in my mind. And if you can do that correctly, if you match the right budget with the right creative partner, then you're valuing the industry correctly. So I think in my mind, creative services have been subject to like their work being devalued for decades.
Absolutely.
Zach, I mean, especially like post-recession, like my whole art department at Disney got let go in 2009 because of the, you know, economy collapsing.
Yeah.
So in most cases, that was common. You know, art departments, design departments were the first to get cut when the economy crashed. Yeah. So, you know, I think for those companies, instead of figuring out a way to quickly reemploy all those workers at a livable wage, I think most of them ended up taking advantage of the fact that these workers, we, would work for just about any amount of money.
Yeah.
So we were paid, the creative class was paid less and less and less. And then to kind of fill that void, products and services, and I think some of these are really good ideas, like Squarespace and stuff like that. Those further devalued creative work because they flooded the market and made it easier for companies to go around, you know, traditional hiring. And they would just contract workers or they would buy something that was already pre-made and just customize it a little bit. And I think that kept the market down.
Yeah.
So I think just to finish this rant real quick.
No, no.
The reason a lot of these designers and creatives keep doing it for less than they're worth is because they were constantly told, you need to keep doing what you love. And I think some took on part-time work. And I think if you look at like economic stats, you can see that part-time jobs are up and so are freelance workers. And I feel like those two things are related. And I think you can pinpoint it back to a crashing economy and then companies that were able to take advantage of the creative class because of the situation that they were in.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so many good points there. And I think, I think the economy, you know, crashing in 2008 definitely kind of started the snowball rolling into where, you know, there's these now stock solutions from everything from stock illustrations. And that's something, you know, as illustrators, we battle on our side. And then, you know, obviously stock websites from Squarespace or Weebly, that's something I know you have to kind of deal with in your industry. Uh-huh. And I think it's, just that definitely devalues our kind of workflow or, you know, the creative class, like you said. But I think, like you said, too, is like we're willing to kind of take less to keep doing what we do. What do you think, Maria?
Yeah, it seems like it gives people who are doing what they love like a general like low self-esteem when it comes to how they view what they're doing. And when I started my last agency, I was bringing designers on, and every single one of them had this like very like they were super talented, but they had super low self-esteem when it came to like you know, getting money from clients. Like people just wouldn't pay them and they just wouldn't really pursue it, you know, like they just they were too like shy or humble or they didn't feel like, I don't know, I guess I didn't feel this like fire enough to go pursue it and make sure they got paid, make sure they got reimbursed, or I don't know, they weren't promoting themselves well. It's almost like they're doing this amazing work, but like they couldn't put it into motion in the real world because their like self-esteem was so low. So I was offering them, you know, opportunity with working through an agency to like protect them and make sure they get paid because we'll be the in-between. But it's like sad because I've met a lot of designers and it seems to be like this general like it issue that I've just been noticing, and I'm like, okay, where's this coming from? And I feel like the economy definitely pushed it into that direction. So, you know, there's this Forbes article that we also were reading, and another one by Red Lemon Club, but it was like a video, and they both kind of said like, you know, a lot of people don't know what their passions are yet, you know, like, and so how would you address that issue? Like, so, you know, we're talking about people who are doing what they love. What about people who don't know what they love yet?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, well, Nate, what, do you have anything to add to that kind of that idea about, you know, maybe there's a lot of creative people out there that don't know, or maybe just in any industry that they don't know, you know, even how to find their passion, and should they even try to find their passion? You know, what do you think about that?
I think as far as finding your passion is concerned, if you look at the fact that, you know, freelance statistics are up and more people are freelancing now than they maybe ever have been in the country, I think you'll see that most people are probably not picking a creative field just because they love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of people pick creative fields really. They mask it with the do what you love mantra, but I think most people pick those creative fields because they actually think you can make money in them. You know, yeah. I mean, if I did what I do love what I do, absolutely. But I don't love it the same way that I love playing drums or guitar or being in a band.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah, I don't. But I know that I'm going to actually be able to make a living doing what I'm doing now, you know, and the road to get there, if I were going to play in a band, would be so much harder, you know? So, I do think that, you know, especially living in a city like Austin, I know so many people that work at tech companies during the day and then they have bands at night, or they, you know, work at bars during the day or at night. And then on the weekends, their bands play. And so I do think that there are ways to do it, I think that, Maria, to your point, you do need to actually know what you want to do, and you need to know why you want to put energy into it. Mm-hmm. And I actually, there's a quote from that Forbes article. Let me find it really quick. So it's the Seth Godin part where he quotes Seth Godin. And he says, Seth Godin once told the story of a gifted friend who took on a draining grunt role at a record company because music was his bliss. Godin wondered rightly if this friend could have served himself and society better if he worked as a school teacher during the day and spent his spare time pursuing his passion. And I think that that is the irony, in my opinion, is that this whole article is kind of trashing on do what you love, but nobody would fault anybody for doing that.
Right.
You know, I mean, Zach, you worked as a basketball coach for a long time, and you were passionate about basketball. I know that. But in your spare time, you were working on all of these new skills as a designer.
Yeah.
You know, and you're making that transition from what was making you money to what you want to make you money. And I think that that is the way to do it. You know, so I feel like for me, that's the reason I can't completely trash the do what you love mantra. And I do think it takes some experimenting. You know, I think it takes a long time to figure out what you're passionate about, and then to figure out if it's even something that you want to make money from.
No, that's a very good point, actually. Yeah. You know, I think there's a big difference between doing what you love and then doing what you love in order to pay the bills. You know, like you said, there's a lot of people that love maybe to be a musician or be an artist or filmmaker or whatever, kind of, especially because we usually talk about creatives. It's one thing when you're doing what you love and there's no boss and there's no deadline and, you know, there's no time that needs to be spent in a recording studio. When you have none of those, guidelines or parameters around you, and you're totally free to do what you want, quote unquote, do what you love, you know, that's great and it sounds good. But then, you know, when, you know, you have a creative director breathing down your neck or a client or, you know, something along those lines, it kind of changes maybe your perception of what you love, and maybe you didn't love it as much as you thought you did, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there's that for sure. And
I think that's the reason that over the last few years, 10 years really, you've had a lot of people really stressing the distinction between an artist and, say, a designer, you know.
Yeah.
Because there are I know a lot of designers who are very, very talented designers, but unless they have full creative control, they don't play nice, you know. So they're not really professional designers. They may be designers, but they're more artistic designers than they are somebody that would be able to go into the marketplace and actually love what they do, you know, as part of their day job.
No, yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I just recently graduated, you know, from, you know, Cal State Channel Islands, and we had a lot of really, really talented artists and designers in our program. And I think it's a great point. You know, there was, you know, we would see the, you know, just guys and girls and all kinds of creative people just creating these beautiful works of art for maybe like an album cover or something. But then when they were asked to put on type or change the color by our teacher because he was trying to act like as our creative director, they would be super resistant. And they were just kind of saying, well, you know, this is my design and I love it. And, you know, our teachers were kind of saying, well, that's great, but that's not how the real world works. And
totally.
So I think a lot of the problem with the do what you love mindset, and we could kind of talk about this a little bit, especially like in the internet culture, we're always getting to see the best of maybe a profession or a lifestyle, you know, so we're able to kind of, you know, go to these designer blogs or just these creative blogs in general and just see nice photos of an apartment or a creative studio and everyone's dressed really nicely, you know, and they're talking about how great design is, and we don't get to see what happens when the cameras are shut off and no one's there, like the studio gets messy, the clients are getting crazy. We don't get to see that part. You know, we always get to see, you know, the really like nice parts of the creative industry when we go to these blogs and try to get inspired, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of, that's kind of our culture at this point, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's look at all this sexy, shiny stuff. And then like, yeah, don't look over there. Like that's kind of, you know, and I think that that's where this mantra, that's why this mantra does really well. Cause even people who are in the middle of just some crazy, crazy stuff, and they know that their day job is really hard work. They don't always let themselves look at the bad parts. They don't always deal with them directly. And they certainly don't want to talk about it or vent about it too much on things like social media. And that makes it tougher to have an honest conversation about stuff like this.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny that you mentioned, you guys were mentioning the kind of the illusion of what's behind, like what the creative field seems like. And I could see how easy it is for someone who's trying to find that creative passion to like idealize what it's like. And I think there's a lot of disappointment where people are like, okay, yeah, that's the life I want. I want to dress that way. I want to look that way. They fall in love with the aesthetic more than the craft. And that's kind of like the difference between how you know someone's really passionate about something and when someone's doing it because it's cool. And I've actually seen a lot of people who are doing it because it's cool. And,
We know a few of those, Nate.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Everyone does, yeah, I think, totally. Right? But, you know, it's, like, funny, like, we did another podcast on social media, and, like, we talk about how everything's so curated. So, like, you know, it looks like they're super successful, and they're super, like, chic, but then you find out, like, you know, they just moved back home, and, you know, it's, like, this whole, like, illusion, but we kind of have to create an illusion to an extent so that...
They just have to have really good natural lighting at home.
Yeah, exactly. Like, everything's exactly. So perfect, and so I think that a lot of, like, the younger people, too, like, are caught up because of social media into, like, oh, how cool would it be to be a designer or a creative, but then, you know, but it's mostly hard work. It's mostly, like, that grit and, like, maybe having to take another job while you're creating. And so, yeah, it's interesting to see how everything's kind of misconstrued in the creative world as far as like people who are doing it for passion or doing it for, you know, for the look or the money or whatever, or what they perceive as money, because we all know how hard it is to make money as a creative.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and Maria, to your point about people who don't want to put in the hard work, I do think that that's a problem today. You know, but whenever I talk to somebody who's, you know, a generation ahead of us, and they want to talk about how, you know, our generation never works and we don't like working and all that kind of stuff, I always have to push back a little bit and just say, you know, me, the two of us, all of my friends, all of our friends, Zach, the kind of, again, to go back to it, the kind of economy we came into the workforce under made it really, really tough to actually break into anything.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that the irony is, as much as we all hate the kind of self-promotion, and I am a hater of all the self-promotion, it's part of the job now, and it's weird. Yep. You know, like if you are going to make it, you do have to put on that facade of everything's great.
Exactly. You know,
or you have to figure out a sexy way to say that nothing about your job is sexy. So it's weird, you know. it's like that is part of the hard work of making it now, is trying to figure out how to communicate what you love about what you do without coming across too icky, I guess.
Icky. That's the technical term for it.
That is the technical term.
Absolutely. I think I saw that somewhere in a book or something.
yeah. I mean, and to me that, but again, I mean, to go back to the idea that people aren't working very hard, I struggle to say that they aren't, but I know that in most cases for anything that is very creative, you have a lot of starting and a lot of stopping for people. They may decide they want to be a designer one week, get Illustrator, that's too hard, get a camera, go out and start shooting some videos or some photos, start, you know, something around that. That's too hard. Move on to something else. There are a lot of people like that out there too. And so don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that I actually think everybody on our, in our generation in this economy is actually, you know, carrying their own weight,
yeah,
so to speak. And I do think that because of that, and because of all these people who are trying, you know, one passion and dropping it and moving to another passion and dropping it, I think because of that, it makes it easier for companies to continue to take advantage of devaluing work.
Exactly.
Because you have a lot of people that come into an industry and say, I'm going to do this for a long time. They're in it for 2 years. They're building their portfolio. They give up, they move on, and that keeps things down. So I don't know.
That's a good
point. I don't know if that made any sense at all, but
I think it made some sense.
Yeah, definitely. It did make sense. Yeah. So and that goes along with the idea of basically like the glamour. So people are going into the field, like you were saying, and then people are taking advantage of people who have this perception of what it's going to be. And I mean, I can relate to that a bit. Like, I did fashion for a really long time and I thought like that was it. I mean, I was like in architecture school when I started my fashion design thing back up again, and I started to have some success, but no one wanted to pay me. Like, I was in magazines, like I was getting written about, and I had shows, and
the social currency was there,
and no one paid me crap. But it looked like I was legit, like, but no, like I got so tired of like wasting so many resources to drive, to go to shows, to be in magazines all day and be exhausted, and to go home with no money at all and just be like a poor starving student who's also a fashion designer. I was like, and after a while it just got to the point where I'm like, I love this. I like absolutely just adore fashion design, but at the end of the day I had to do something that I both could really enjoy and could make me money. So that, like, especially I think fashion is a big industry where people are taking advantage of people who are wanting to make it, you know, because everyone, a lot of people think fashion is so easy to break into, but like a lot of creative fields, it's just the illusion. And so, yeah, I know I can directly relate to that a lot.
Yeah, and I think that's a good kind of segue back to Proxart, which had a ton of social currency,
We were like social currency billionaires,
but we couldn't turn that into real cash.
Yeah.
And I think that part of that was by design. Part of that was that it was a labor of love. It was always going to be a labor of love. But it got weird when it was like, okay, everybody's an adult now and we kind of need to start making money. And, you know, it's different for an individual. Maria, I think in your case, it's a little bit of a bang your head against the wall sort of thing, because you are getting attention. You are getting, you know, maybe you're getting work, but it's all under the guise of like, well, we'll help you build your portfolio.
Exactly. It's everything was like a barter and a trade, you know?
Yeah.
I think,
exactly.
I think bartering got big in the creative world.
It did. And it is a contributing factor to people continuing to make less and companies continuing to make less.
Yeah.
And things like that. You know, I mean, companies are always going to try to find the best quality work that they can for the lowest price. That's like the intersection where they make their decision. In most cases, I mean, you've got some companies out there that just don't care. They just throw out money, you know, like it's going out of style, because for them it is. but in 99% of cases, you've got people who, there are companies that are just trying to find the best that they can for the lowest price. And I think that, I think that for people who continue to take on work at a wage that's lower than they're worth, it ends up affecting the market on the whole. And I think that, again, to go back to it, I think that something like Do What You Love can be used as a crutch for people in their heads to think, well, okay, I'm not making what I should be making, but, you know, I could be flipping burgers.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's all about perspective.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's good. I think it's good for people to have some of that, but I think it's something simple, right? I mean, if we're going to talk a little bit about solutions for some of this stuff, I think part of it is on the creative class to know how to communicate that they know what they're worth, even if they're offering a discount.
Yes, exactly.
You know, like for example, with Toy, we regularly discount our hourly rate for, you know, nonprofits and things like that. But they never don't know that they're getting a significant discount, you know?
Yeah.
So if we're working with them, we'll tell them, you know, our normal hourly rate is X, but we're going to give you a lower hourly rate of X. And then we're going to show you in the math how much of a discount you're getting. So, you know, you know, we're absorbing some of this cost. We're not making as much as we could be because we like you.
You know,
or we believe in your cause, or we whatever. And so I think for people in our industries, it's important to know how to or when to charge less than what you should be. It's also important, I think, to know how to communicate to somebody that you are charging less than you're worth.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and thank you for segueing into kind of like how we wanted to wrap up, which is kind of like, what's the solution? Mm-hmm. I think you kind of touched on a little bit of it already, you know, just kind of knowing your own self-worth and being able to communicate that to a potential client or a boss. You know, but also I think it's kind of, you know, taking the time to be a master of your craft. And if you really love what you're doing, you know, follow through and leave yourself room for to develop the mastery, you know, that you need to be successful at your craft, and almost going to get to the point where people are coming to you. Bosses are coming to you. Clients are coming to you, and you become the on-demand commodity instead of the client or the person dangling the job in front of you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And you know, that just takes time. It takes understanding exactly the different factors that are in play in running a business as well, you know? And I think that for a lot of people on the creative end, you know, this is the reason you end up with structures around creative people. I think because anybody that's going to become a master in a creative discipline is probably not going to be an accounting master.
Yes.
You know, they're probably not going to be great at some of the more administrative things. And so I think that's why if you look at a lot of really well-known artists or designers or design teams or art directors or whatever, you look at those structures that they're that they have in place around themselves, and those end up contributing to let them do what they love, you know? So I think that you need that kind of balance between knowing what you're good at and knowing what you're not good at, and knowing how to delegate everything that you're not good at.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add real quickly. That's such a good point. Like, you know, there's a lot of people that I've come across. They're like, oh, what are we going to name our agency or our business, and how are we going to get clients? And I always think, yeah, that's important. But I always joke with Maria. I'm like, yeah, when do we get to hiring an accountant, and how are we going to pay our taxes every year? You know, that's like, yeah, those are the first things. Yeah, the unromantic stuff, yeah, is the stuff we think about first. But
totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I read a story about the financial crash, actually, and it was during the 2008 election and all that kind of stuff. And it was the day after the markets crashed, I guess, and the Obama team was getting together to go over campaign planning. Mm-hmm. And they were going to talk about, you know, what their strategy was and all that kind of stuff. And the story that I've read, and I've read multiple accounts of this, so I think it really happened. Who knows? But the story that I read was that Obama came in for the meeting, and everybody was talking about, like, well, you know, here's what we're going to do. And, you know, here's how we're going to position this and all of that kind of stuff. And I, you know, Obama just kind of stopped everybody. And he was like, okay, guys, everybody's worried about what is going to happen if we lose. And he's like, but based on everything I'm hearing right now about how the economy is going, how, you know, all this other stuff is going, I'm actually more concerned about what are we going to do if we win?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know,
yeah.
Like, what's going to happen if we actually win this? Can we start talking about all the things that we're going to have to be thinking about now, like 2.5, 3 months in advance, 5 months in advance of when I'd actually get into office? Because I'm actually more concerned about, I'm not concerned about how it looks. I'm concerned about what we're actually going to do, you know? And so I think that, at least for me, a story like that is just, it's a cautionary tale. Cause it's like, you know, of course everybody's going to look at the shiny stuff and everybody's going to look at, you know, is it sexy or is it not? But I think it's on, again, it's on me, it's on you guys, it's on the entire creative class to be able to say, okay, we need to surround ourselves with people that can let us do what we love. And we also need to understand that we're going to have to deal with a lot of stuff that is not part of what we love, but that's going to allow us to actually continue doing what we love.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's actually a great way to close out today. Because, you know, I know you got to run, Nate, and we really appreciate your time today and your insight on this topic. Is there anything you kind of want to say to close us out?
No, man, this was fun. I'd love to come hang out again.
Definitely.
Oh, we definitely want to have you back. yeah, I know you know how I feel about your opinions and insights, so we definitely want to have you back, right, Maria?
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate all your insight.
Well, I hope it was actually insightful. We'll listen back and find out if I said anything that made sense. I'm gonna go get more coffee though.
Yeah, we wonder that every podcast. Like, is anyone gonna like understand what we're saying? So,
Well, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nate. We appreciate it.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
And thank you to our listeners. You know, give us feedback on what you want to talk about in the future. If you want to kind of comment on this podcast and, you know, direct us, you know, you guys are driving the bus and we're excited to talk about things that you might be interested in hearing about. So thanks again. And this is Creative Honey.
We'll talk to you soon.